Hello and welcome to Hot Yoga Radio. We're off in fantastic sunshine here in Wolverhampton. It feels absolutely tropical, very, very high humidity, but the sun is sparkling on the water and there are many, many ducklings, and it really is, the day is smiling for sure. So this is going to be episode 15 of our Lao Tzu series we're going to do today. So we're going to be tackling chapters 25 and 26. So Pete's going to read one out and then we're going to have a bit of a chat about it, and then we'll have a crack at the next one and again just have a bit of a chat about that.
Chapter 25 of the Tao Te Ching. Before the world was, and the sky was filled with stars, there was a strange, unfathomable body. This being, this body, is silent and beyond all substance and sensing. It stretches beyond everything, spanning the empyrean. It has always been here, and it always will be. Everything comes from it, and then it is the mother of everything. I do not know its name, so I call it Tao. I am loath to call it greater than everything, but it is. And being greater, it infuses all things, moving far out and returning to the source. Tao is great, Tao the great. It is greater than heaven, greater than the earth, greater than the king. There are four great things, and the ruler is the least of them. Humanity is schooled by the earth. Earth is taught by heaven, and heaven is guided by the Tao. And the Tao goes with what is absolutely natural.
Okay, so let's see what is Lao Tzu talking about here.
Well, he's returning to his cosmological theme, as he does so often. It seems almost every other chapter, or every few chapters, you get this reiteration of the underpinning cosmology of this contemplative Taoism. And then it's followed by some advice as to what we as individuals, as contemplatives perhaps, can do about that, how we can utilise this big vision. So it's a bit repetitious in some ways. But there is a bit of a fresh angle as well. And what I draw out of this as one of the big themes is that Lao Tzu attempts to, like mystics in all ages, to experience and conceive of something that's absolutely the ultimate, the greatest, the ultimate, that which precedes everything. And it is an attempt, sort of quite similar to what we find in Platonism, you know, finding the empyrean.
Just in case anyone doesn't know what empyrean is, because to be honest, well, it just means when I first read that, I thought that's an interesting word. I've not seen that
it
one.
It just
means
it means that the heavens, you know, the ultimate, but in the sense it's the ultimate transposed onto the cosmos. So it would be the heavens, the highest heaven.
Yeah,
is the empyrean. Smart thing that Lao Tzu does here is to avoid making the Tao transcendent to such a degree that it stands outside of everything, it's separate from everything, it's a completely other realm. He avoids that, and I think he is even alert to the danger of doing that.
Yeah.
And this is what he means when he says, I am loath to call it greater than everything, but it is. It is greater than everything, but he's loath to call it greater than everything. Well, why? Because we will turn it into something that's beyond our grasp, beyond our reach, beyond our experience. And yet his whole point is that we can align with it. Even though it's greater than everything, we as tiny human beings can align with it, can experience it, can conceptually grasp it, perhaps, in a certain sense. So this is why he's asserting the transcendence of the Tao, of its existence before everything else, and after everything else, on the one hand, at the same time as not wanting to place that temptation before us of creating a beyond which we can use conceptually to escape from life, or to deny life, or to become a benchmark by which we would measure this world and find it wanting. And he's very alert to that, I think. I think that little oxymoron there, or that little contradictory statement there, does that for us. And indeed, later on, he goes on to say, in fact, in the very next line, and being greater than everything, it infuses all things, moving far out and returning to the source. But that it infuses all things.
So even it's not though like it's you have to go looking for it or even, seeking it, because it's in everything already.
Yeah, even though it's beyond everything. Yeah. It was there before the universe as we know it, before the world existed, before the world was. There was a strange, unfathomable body. The Tao was there before the world. The Tao will be there after the world, when everything's gone back to the source. It is the creative matrix. I think it's the mother. And so it is. It does have this transcendent quality, but at the same time, it infuses all things, which means it's got an immanent quality. And that manoeuvre on his part cuts off that sort of retreat from life into the beyond, into heaven, into the greater platonic reality that's above everything else. And so he actually helps us to avoid world calumny. Or slandering the world, or slandering life.
Is that what world calumny means?
Yeah.
What a great word.
It helps us to avoid life negation.
Yeah.
Whilst bringing into our picture of existence some notion of the transcendent. See, for Lao Tzu, the transcendent and the immanent are the same. They're again, other opposites. You know, this whole thing is about the fusion of opposites. And the yin and yang, and night and day, and male and female, and so on. But one of the pair of opposites that Lao Tzu brings together into a mischievous conjunction is the pair of opposites of transcendence and immanence. And these concepts place the ultimate, the greatest thing, both in the beyond but also right into the very core of every type of existence that there is, including ducks and pebbles and clouds and flowers and human beings and so forth. The Tao is everywhere. And this is a masterstroke, it strikes me, of bringing together immanent and transcendent in a alchemical wedding of opposites. In the latter half of chapter 25, Lao Tzu categorises aspects of the world as being earth, heaven, the king, and the Tao. The Tao being this thing that can include everything and infuse everything. But within that, we've got earth, and human beings are schooled by earth, Lao Tzu says. Well, of course we are. Yeah. We see the world according to our necessities, as organic beings, subject to gravity, walking on the surface of a planet, based on a carbon, organic chemistry style of animality. And this is the way Earth schools humanity. All right. And Earth is taught by heaven. Well, okay, the Earth itself its constraints and possibilities are all determined by the fact that it's a planet orbiting around the sun through more or less empty space, and on the halfway out from the centre of a rotating galaxy with a black hole at the centre, blah blah blah. There's so much about the Earth that's determined by that. You know, the gravity that I spoke about that constrains our existence as we move about, as animals, as physical objects, as organic beings, is determined by the greater physics of heaven, the gravitational constant, and so forth, which are features of heaven. Such things as the gravitational constant, it governs the rotation of all the planets and of the galaxy itself, and so forth. So it's just kind of smart cosmology, you know. It's very simplified and general and poetic, as you would expect given the time when it was written. But it does indicate some very far-reaching contemplation of things, of existence itself, and the human beings' place in it. And heaven, of course, is guided by the Tao. Of course, he says, well, there is this kind of ultimate principle, which, repeating endlessly, is a creative principle. It's the mother, it's the matrix, but also is a principle of dynamism, but also a principle which brings together opposites, including the opposites, importantly here, of transcendence and immanence. And then he finishes off, and the Tao goes with what is absolutely natural. Well, okay, we've talked about what natural is before, and it's a kind of slightly dodgy concept in our era. But you can say that the Tao is in the grain of everything. You know, you could actually say, you could turn that on its head, and more accurately, I would say, that the absolutely natural goes with the Tao. It's the Tao which determines the natural, the patterns of growth and decay of all these plants and these trees, and the fish in the water and the ducklings and the seasons, the weather, day and night. That this grain of existence, the fractal nature of things, are all progeny of the great Tao. Okay, I'm going to go on to chapter 26, Lao Tzu's insight into cosmology, which we've just elucidated, derives from his own meditative experience. And in the following chapter, chapter 26, Lao Tzu gives us some very down-home instructions on how we might do the same. And you find this pattern in the Lao Tzu of some cosmology, some big overarching explanation of the Tao, the fusion of opposites, the dynamic character of existence, the goodness of life, followed by some kind of meditative instruction for an individual. And this is what we've got here again. So we've tended to separate these in the way we've put this together. But this time we're going to just bring them together so you can see the cosmology deriving from his meditative experience and the way that cosmology can underpin and inspire us to our own meditative and contemplative project. Here it is then, chapter 26. What holds, what you can trust, is the same as this quietness. And it is light-hearted. Quiet, light-hearted silence is the key to being free from emotion. The sage never abandons the Tao. He never lets its weight out of his sight. He may live in a fabulous house, but he never gets caught up wanting to. And though there are always temptations, he stays unswayed and smiles. So why is it that our rulers seem so bright but are glib and insubstantial. Losing the weight of the Tao means you lose your root. And when you can't sit still, you lose the source. So the meditative effort, even though effort is totally the wrong word, is very simple, very light. Not overcomplicated, not technical. It's almost that when sitting, just sit.
Yeah.
When you can't sit still, you lose the source. If you can sit still, the implication is we gain the source, or we discover our connection with the source. And the source, which means the Tao, the matrix, the mother, that kind of point out of which everything is being created and destroyed moment to moment, everywhere, always. And what is required? Sit still.
Yeah.
If you can't sit still, just learn to sit still. Just keep having a go until you can do it. Like riding a bike, you know. And even right at the beginning, he says it to you, you know. What holds, what you can trust, is the same as this quietness. Quietness, sitting quietly doing nothing. Since what is extolling? The virtue of quietness. And the whole thing, as we've said, the whole Taoist approach is a quietism. Particularly this contemplative Taoism, you know, it's non-technical, it's quiet. It puts you in mind of like the Stoic ataraxia, you know, the thought that, well, we don't want too many strong emotions throwing us here, there and everywhere. And he does in fact say that, you know. This quiet, light-hearted silence is the key to being free from emotion. He actually doesn't mean just totally free from emotion, because light-heartedness is an emotion.
Yeah,
you
yeah.
Know, human life is emotion. But what is extolling is a quietness.
Yeah, that could be really misunderstood, yeah, that line,
yeah,
there.
And he's
that,
he's yeah. just saying, well, it, you know, stop being fucking hysterical. And there are some kind of more refined, quieter, light-hearted emotions that you can avail yourself of just through quietness and sitting quietly. So you have to be a bit careful with that. But what he says about this quietness is that it's light-hearted. And this is really important. I mean, Lao Tzu comes across as quite a kind of a... He's quite somber, isn't he? He's slightly melancholic, quite somber. But his follower, Chang Tzu, was a really humorous character. His work's kind of full of jokes and quirky stories. And it is really, really light-hearted. There's tremendous humour in it. And Chang Tzu brought this aspect of contemplative Taoism to the fore. But Lao Tzu mentions it. He says there is a light-heartedness. He's not grave. He's not like... sit until you go blind, austere, ascetic contemplation. It's light-hearted, it's easy. And this is really, really important. And you can get it, you know, you can be too serious about it all. And Lao Tzu doesn't help in that respect, because he's a bit of a sombre character, you know, he's a bit melancholic. And he was a bit world-weary, there's no doubt about it. You know, he's leaving the madness of the world to go up the mountain and sit in a cave until death takes him. Is what he's about, you know. Let's say Chang Tzu. Funny, very, very funny. He really get that light-heartedness. And this is a definite thing. You sit quietly, and you just kind of forget for a bit. I mean, the Taoist meditation that I like, it's just simply called forgetting. The idea is you sit quietly, doing nothing, and you forget. You just let yourself forget. You know, and okay, your problems and the conundrums and the practical affairs of life are not going to go away. When you stand up and go out, go back to the office, you'll be able to kind of deal with this stuff. And it's actually a practical approach, you know. It says what holds and what you can trust is the same as this quietness. You can trust that quietness. And it kind of orders things for you of its own accord just by entering into the quietness.
It's funny how it does that.
So that the practical stuff doesn't weigh so heavy on you. You can even see the funny side of some really dark shit, you know. And
This well, is what it, different perspectives, and yeah, that's very important.
Well, it is. That lightens your heart, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Why do you become heavy in your heart? Well, it's because you're kind of stuck in one perspective, stuck in a bubble.
Yeah.
You're kind of trapped in a cage of emotion. Yeah. And you can't see out of it. And it all seems hopeless. And if you sit and meditate, it rubs your nose in it. If you can't just allow that quietness to just lighten your heart, which it will do. And then the heart becomes very light. And this is a definite emotion, stroke sensation. It's very, very delicate and very beautiful. And trustworthy, as the man says. He's very practical. Keep saying this. The guy is very, very practical. At the same time as we have this kind of lightheartedness, the Tao itself is heavy. You don't lose the heaviness of the Tao, he says it. And he attributes the glibness of rulers to their loss of connection with the Tao, their loss of the heaviness of the Tao. He says the sage never abandons the Tao and never lets its weight out of his sight. And there is a kind of a weight to it. Your heart is light, but there's the weight. And I sometimes talk about it, it's like the weight of the moment. Somebody years ago was talking to me about, they wanted me to comment on the title of a book, The Unbearable Lightness of Being, by Milan Kundera. And I've read that book actually and seen that there's a film as well. Very interesting, very good. But I just said to this guy, you know, being's not light. Being is actually heavy. You know, there's a kind of an imponderable weight when you sit. And you do find that quietness. There's a weight, almost like the weight of the entirety of existence, the gravity of life and death. At the same time as your heart accepts all this, and it feels very light and delicious and sweet at the same time. And he's dead right about that. There are some very important clues in this chapter for our contemplation and our meditation. But the rulers, yeah, lose the weight of the Tao. So they lose their root. And again, he's referring to this tree metaphor that he likes so much, or plant metaphor, that you need roots. We are in the earth. The earth schools man, as we just discovered. We're connected to the earth. And your major connection with the earth is to have your roots in the earth. Actually, in organic, natural life and the life processes itself, the body and the processes of the body, eating, shitting, procreating, breathing, you know, all this is grist to the mill. We don't deny it. Taoism is very good at avoiding the pitfall of life negation, which so many other spiritualities very easily slip into, especially when they fail to realize that transcendence is also immanence. So, good stuff, Lao Tzu. I like it.
Aye.
And when you can't sit still, you lose the source. So here's the advice. Well, just sit until you can do it. And it doesn't take that long. And it's okay to forget. You're not being irresponsible, because you let yourself forget now and then. Blessed are the forgetful.
Yeah.
For they will get the better even of their blunders.
About the just sit business.
Yeah.
There are times when you think, right, I'm going to just sit. And you sit there.
Yeah.
And you all these horrible whirlpools in your mind. You think, no, I'm going to do it. And it's funny, but sometimes you can just exhaust yourself.
Yeah.
And like, actually, what you needed to do was maybe just go out for a walk and just
yeah,
or go and stare at the sky for a while.
Yeah,
that works. Sort of did that different ways in.
That works too.
Yeah,
we don't need to fetishize sitting.
No,
but he just brought it in there. You know, so if you can't sit still,
sometimes you need to. It's a bit of a slow wind down.
I mean, the key thing is availing yourself of the silence, however you do that.
Yeah.
And it's not like you've got to cultivate silence. We have to keep saying that, because the Tao is silent. It's also like a roar of 10 million lightning storms at the same time. But the Dow is this, the great silence is where the Dow is apparent to us. But we are infused with it. We depend on it. Our lives wouldn't be here at all without it. Everything, all things are infused with the Dow, including us, particularly us. So we can avail ourselves of the silence. We don't need to cultivate it, we have it. But it is elusive, I have to keep saying this. None of this is difficult, but it is a bit elusive.
There's different ways, and sometimes there can be such blockages. And speaking of that, I've mentioned this many times before, but if you're sitting or trying to do some meditation, or you're trying to be quiet, and you can't be, and it's all you encounter is just agitation and pain, an excellent way and a very quick way to just, it's almost like a when a river has become all blocked with branches and things from the previous storms, when there's like a really big storm and a huge body of water just smashes its way down the river and just clears all the blockages out the way. If you want to have that sort of thing been going on inside you, and I know this sounds a bit obvious, but have a good cry.
Yeah.
It's amazing how much that can clear those blockages so quickly.
Yeah.
And it's very good if you can.
Yeah.
I try and incorporate some crying, whether I need to or not, into my my own practice, just as a bit of a clear out. Even just if I'm just feeling a bit agitated because I'm tired or I've been too busy, even if there's nothing particularly major that's causing me to feel distressed or anything.
Yeah.
It's just an excellent way just to kind of give yourself a bit of a clean out.
Mm. Well, it's the elusive nature of the ever-present and dependable and cosmically significant, transcendent and imminent silence is that as human beings we get snared up, we get blocked up, and we sit and there's just this kind of like turmoil. That might be
anyone who's ever done yoga or meditation for the first time, I think will definitely have experienced some of that.
But it's kind of okay. You start then approaching that turmoil as though it was like a project and a task, and you can write a timeline and a white paper on how to deal with it. But it's just going to retreat further.
And just another note about this cry meditation. It's very important. When you let yourself go into the crying, don't focus your mind on a reason for the crying. I'm upset because he said, she said, this happened, that happened.
Yeah.
Your mind will start to do that, but just let that go. Because if you start focusing on a reason, you'll just wind yourself up. Just focus on the sensation of the crying and the sensation of just letting the emotion go. That's all you need.
Yeah.
And I'd be really, really quick. Just a little note there.
Well, as you can discern, what Lucy's talking about there, he's a tad elusive. But I will repeat, not difficult. Because it's waiting for you. It's there. It cannot not be there. You wouldn't be here if it wasn't there. If that ultimate silence wasn't there, you wouldn't be here.
Yeah.
None of this would be here.
And just realising that can just do it in itself. It's because that's so relaxing.
Yeah. Just settling in.
Just to know that you don't have to strive. It's just there already.
Settling in. And well, okay, encounter what you encounter. It's not a council of perfection. And Lecce is very careful about this, about not to dangle a desideratum in front of you too strongly, which then creates its own labyrinth of complications for you, you know. And of course we all do it, we're almost bound to do it. And okay, it's one of these things, you learn to ride a bike, you fall off a couple of times.
Oh yeah,
and then you don't.
Yeah.
So, you know, and it's all cool, it's all cool. The crying's cool, the turmoil's cool, the hysterical emotion's cool. But just know, this is all you need to know, really, just know that it is there. I promise you, the great silent doe is there. And sometimes that's all that you can do. As an improver of humanity, it's just...
just keep pointing.
It's one of these absurd kind of creatures, is to just say, well, it's there, I promise you. But find out for yourself. That's it, this is what he's doing. And very, very ably, I think. So...
I think that's probably everything then.
Yeah, we could go on forever about this, couldn't we, you know, but...
I'm sure we will be revisiting these themes many times
What's going on, according to Lao Tzu's vision, his contemplative vision, a vision born of contemplation. You will see this too. And the contemplative method that is underpinned by it, that arises out of it and that leads back to it. That's it. And it's hardly a method, very light touch, which is what's beautiful about him. Very, very light touch, light-heartedness, humour, remember. Even though he doesn't remind us that much of that. So I think we'll call it a day on that.
Okay, well, I hope you found that interesting, everybody. Thanks for listening, and we'll be speaking to you again soon.